Well, hello everybody. For those of you I've not met before, my name's Kath and I'm on the leadership team here at this church. And if you haven't been to KXC before, you've just joined us in the middle of a teaching series. We're working through Mark's gospel at the moment, and today we've hit chapter 3. So if you've got a Bible with you, the first thing you want to do, might want to do, is just to turn open to Mark chapter 3. And if you don't have a Bible, there should be some in the pews in front of you. And if you don't own a Bible, feel free to take that Bible home with you at the end of the service today too. But before we dive straight into the text today, I just wanted to do a little mini recap of where we've been at the past couple of weeks. Pete's been doing the teaching for the past couple of weeks, and I'm going to try and summarise in about 30 seconds what he said in 2 weeks, which would have saved us all a lot of time. but here we go. Here it is in a nutshell. So this week one, we were looking at Mark chapter 1, and that's all about Jesus revealing his mission to restore creation to how it was always meant to be. How it was back in the beginning in the Garden of Eden when God was king, and Adam and Eve were therefore, if you like, prince and princess of the garden, which sounds a little bit like a Disney movie, but I assure you it isn't. And their mission was to cultivate the garden and extend it so that it might eventually fill the whole earth. That was their mission. And where it went wrong, Jesus has now come back to restore creation to how it was always supposed to be in the beginning. So that's Mark chapter 1, Jesus reveals his mission. Mark chapter 2 is about Jesus revealing his identity as God himself in human form, returning as that king again to be the one who would bring about that restoration that people were so desperately longing for. So that's what's been happening in Mark chapter 1 and 2. That's my summary in a nutshell. Jesus revealing his mission, first of all, and then Jesus revealing his identity. And then as we start at Mark chapter 3 today, we're going to start doing things a bit differently, because we've moved from looking at Jesus revealing his mission and Jesus revealing his identity, and now we're getting more into the nuts and bolts of how does he actually go about doing this mission? How does he go about beginning to recreate the world? And as we launch into this, we're going to do this in a slightly different way than we have been. For those of you that have been here the past couple of weeks, you'll probably be aware that it's been pretty dense. It's been excellent, but it's been pretty dense. We've been going through the passages kind of verse by verse, and Pete's done a lot of brilliant work on kind of the world behind the text. But we're going to do a little bit less of that moving forward now, and we're more just going to be jumping around the text a bit, trying to pull out strands and thoughts of ideas about how we might outlive this mission in our lives too. But can I just say, as a quick aside before I get started, if you're interested in that sort of stuff, if you just love that slightly geeky stuff of going through the text verse by verse, you love knowing the historical background, you love knowing all the context, then I cannot encourage you enough to get along to Bible and Breakfast on a Tuesday morning. I went for the first time a couple of weeks ago, mainly because Pete was speaking on Pete chapter 3, and I thought, what better way to just get my sermon written for me in advance? But I went along to it, and it was absolutely fantastic. And if you're interested in that sort of stuff, I can't recommend it to you highly enough. But for today, you can breathe a sigh of relief. We're not going to go through the text verse by verse, but we're going to jump in to straight into chapter 3, looking at how did Jesus go about this mission of bringing recreation. And in particular, what I want to home in on today is how did Jesus go about this mission without burning out? How did he do the sorts of things that he did without absolutely burning out? And I wanted to start by asking you this question then. It's just a really simple, straightforward question that people ask you probably every day of your lives. But I want to ask you this question. How are you doing today? How are you doing today? If I was to come round with a roving microphone now, which I'm not going to do because it would be embarrassing for us all, but how would you answer that question? How are you doing today? You know, some of you, I'm sure, would answer saying you feel tip-top, you've had a brilliant weekend full of loads of good fun things that you've been up to. I'm sure others of you would answer differently. But my money is on, at least a handful of people here would answer by saying something like this. I'm all right, thanks. I'm a little bit tired, but I'm okay. Or, how about this one? I'm actually pretty knackered, to be honest with you. Or, I'm okay, it's just been a really busy weekend. You know, one of those weekends where you need another weekend to recover from your weekend? Saying something along those lines. If you're anything like me, you can find yourself, pretty much on a Sunday as well, when people ask you this question all the time, answering that question with those sorts of answers. You're a bit tired, you felt a bit busy, and you find yourself sort of limping into the weekend at the end of your week, thinking, oh, thank God it's the weekend. And then you get to the end of a Sunday and you think, oh no, it's Monday morning. tomorrow, and I still don't quite feel ready for the rest of the week. Now, this is absolutely nothing you haven't heard before, but when you read through Mark's Gospels as a whole, you begin to notice that Jesus has this incredible rhythm of work and rest. As you begin to read through the whole of Mark's Gospel, you'll start to see that happening. Jesus retreats and advances, and I promise you I'm not trying to plug a conference here, but that is absolutely true. Jesus is in this rhythm of retreating and advancing. He lived this incredibly full life, full of people having loads of different demands on him, encountering all sorts of different people who had different agendas, and yet you never want to hear Jesus saying, "I'm just really tired," or, "Oh, I'm just actually so busy at the moment." Instead, you begin to see that pattern of Jesus retreating, spending time alone, spending time with some of his closest friends, on a lake fishing, up a mountainside praying, and then advancing the kingdom, entering the crowds, teaching people, healing people, setting people free from demonic oppression, performing miracles, whatever it is. It's this constant rhythm, retreat, advance, retreat, advance. And I think when you hit Mark chapter 3, you begin to see in particular some real clues and some really practical wisdom, I think, about how we might do the same, how we might build in those rhythms of retreating and advancing so that we're not constantly complaining, or that's not constantly our default answer. I'm all right, I'm just a little bit tired. So, we're going to miss the first chunk of the text to start with, but we will come back to it in a minute, and we're going to read from verse 7 onwards to start with, so you might want to find that and follow along. The text says this: Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions around the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. For he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. And then skip ahead to verse 20. Then Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered, so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. Torture. Then skip ahead to verse 31. Then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. Standing outside, they sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, "Your mother and brothers are outside looking for you." You begin to get the point that three times within a chapter, it talks about crowds pressing in and gathering around Jesus. People pushing and shoving, even to just get a chance to touch him. That was how desperate they were for the life and the healing that he has to offer. But just imagine having that level of demand on you. How the heck do you survive with that level of demand from other people on you? Well, the clue here is back in verse 9, which we've just read, and it says this: because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. You know, maybe for you and your line of work or whatever it is you do, you don't actually have literal crowds of people pressing in on you. Maybe you actually have quite a solitary job or something that means you spend the day by yourself. You're not with loads of people all the time. But have you ever experienced that feeling of overcrowding in your life? It might not be from having literal crowds around you, but the sense that there's too much going on, there's too many people to see, there's too much to do, there's too much need, there's too many places to be. And it's in those times of crowding that we have to do what Jesus did. We have to find our boat. So I want you to ask yourself that question now too. What is your boat? Now, for some of you, you will have been at Bible and Breakfast and you will have done this already, so you've got a head start. But I did it the other week when I was there, and I've honestly found it the most helpful thing to ask that question. What is your boat? And by that I mean, what is the thing or where is the place that you go when you need to escape that sense of being overcrowded? When you feel really tired and when you're at your end, where are the places or the people that you go to where you feel really, really refreshed? So I'll give you an example. I think a really good way to work out what that is for you is to think about the last month. Review your last month and think about the times that you felt the most refreshed or the most relaxed or the most yourself in that month. So I did this for me. And the two things that came to my mind were, one was a Saturday afternoon where I was having a rubbish weekend. I felt really miserable. And my friend Bex phoned me up and she said, do you want to come to the gym with me this afternoon? And I thought, you don't know well me at all. I absolutely do not want to go to the gym with you. And she's like, no, we're not actually going to, you know, do the gym thing. What we're going to do is just do a few token lengths and then we'll in the pool, and then we'll have a jacuzzi and sit in there for a while and chat. And I thought, that sounds much more up my street. So I went for a swim with her, and we did a few more than a few token lengths. It was pretty good going. And then we sat in this jacuzzi for the afternoon and spent the afternoon chatting. I came out like a prune. But it was absolutely brilliant, and I came away feeling totally and utterly refreshed. So that was kind of the first thing in my month that I remembered that I really loved. The second was, it was my birthday last Saturday, so happy birthday to me. I couldn't decide what I wanted to do for my birthday, and I was thinking, I want to do something that's kid-friendly, because I've got a lot of friends with kids, but I also want to do something that I love. And the thing that came to my mind was, I love swimming. I totally love swimming. So I did what every 27-year-old girl does for their birthday, and decided to have a birthday party at Archway Leisure Centre. And invited my friends along, and we had a swimming party, and then we went to McDonald's afterwards. It was great. And Archway Leisure Centre, for those of you that haven't been, isn't the most sophisticated of pools. We definitely saw a plaster floating around in the pool. And I promise you that's not even a joke. And Ian Alexander freaked me out beforehand by telling me the last time he'd been in there they'd had to evacuate because they found a poo in the pool. So I was utterly terrified going into it. But I felt amazing when I came out of that swimming pool. I went down the flume about 15 times. I jumped in the wave machine, bobbed around in the waves a bit, and just generally hanged around in a pool that's kind of too shallow to swim in, really. But it was amazing fun. And at the end of it, I feel totally refreshed. I absolutely love that. Swimming for me is my boat. When I think about the summer, the highlight of my summer is always swimming on Hampstead Heath. That's always what I love doing. Swimming is my boat. You get the idea. What is your boat? Do you know what your boat is? Have you worked out what your boat is in life? And when was the last time you got in it? When was the last time you did one of those things that was kind of just for you, that you came away feeling really, really refreshed by? It's a really simple and practical question, but it's a really important one to work out the answer to if we're going to follow Jesus' example and learn these rhythms of retreating and advancing, working and resting. And the one thing I'd add to this before I move on is beware of the boats that look like boats but aren't actually boats, which I realise is a wordy way of putting it. But beware of the boats that look like boats but aren't actually boats. And what I mean by that is sometimes the things that you think are going to refresh you aren't actually the things that refresh you. So for me, if I feel really, really spent and feel really, really tired, my default position is, ugh, I just feel knackered. I'm going to have a night in, I'm going to cook a massive wadge of pasta, I'm going to drink a big glass of wine, and I'm going to get into some real trash and watch a hideously trashy box set. And that has its merits sometimes, let me tell you, friends, that has its merits sometimes. But I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, not one of the times that I thought of that refreshed me had anything to do with those sorts of nights in. Actually, often what I feel at the end of those sorts of evenings is I feel nothing. I feel numb. It just numbs me. I don't feel refreshed, it just numbs me. And there's a pretty good chance, actually, if you find me 7 series into something dreadful, that I'm actually pretty depressed. I'm not feeling sort of refreshed by that sort of thing. So beware of the boats that aren't actually boats. What are the places that genuinely refresh and restore you? Okay, let's move on. Let's whiz back then, and we're going to start from the end of chapter 2, verse 23. I'm aware we did some of this last week, but it's really important to understand the beginning of chapter 3. So we're going to read from verse 23 in chapter 2, and it says this. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" He answered, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath.' Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, 'Stand up in front of everyone.' Then Jesus asked them, 'Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?' But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger, and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, 'Stretch out your hand.' He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus." So Pete unpacked that bit from chapter 2 last week and explained that part of the reason that the Pharisees were so utterly offended and so furious with Jesus was because in Jewish law, only 2 people could work on the Sabbath. There were 2 groups of people that could work: God, or the temple priests. Those were the only two people that were allowed to work on the Sabbath. So when Jesus is allowing his disciples to pick grain, which maybe doesn't sound like hard work to us, but that was kind of classified as work, he's essentially saying, I am God and my disciples are like priests, which was utterly offensive to them. So they were furious. They thought it was blasphemy. But I think there's another strand of what's going on here too, and this is what I really wanted to home in on. Jesus is, yes, revealing his identity as God, but he's also exposing the hearts of the Pharisees. And he goes further with his challenge in chapter 3, which we've just read. He enters the synagogue and there's this man with a shriveled hand. And the Pharisees are all watching closely to see if he's going to do it, if he's going to heal this man on the Sabbath and break the law. There were laws against healing on the Sabbath because that was seen as work too. Giving medical attention to anybody on the Sabbath was seen as breaking that law unless someone's life was in critical danger. And so Jesus gets this man to stand up so everybody can see what's happening. And then he says this, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? And the text says, he looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, stretch out your hand. And the man's hand is healed. You know, the word Sabbath literally means a deep rest, a deep peace. And it's almost a synonym in the Greek, I think, with the word shalom, which means a state of wholeness and flourishing in every dimension of life. And Tim Keller, when he's commenting on this passage, says this, I think this is beautiful. Why does Jesus become angry with the religious leaders? Because the Sabbath is about restoring the diminished. It's about replenishing the drained. It's about repairing the broken. To heal the man's shriveled hand is to do exactly what the Sabbath is all about. Yet because the leaders are so concerned that Sabbath regulations be observed, they don't want Jesus to heal this man. An incredible example of missing the forest for the trees. Their hearts are as shriveled as the man's hand. They're insecure and they're anxious about the regulations. They're tribal, judgmental and self-obsessed instead of caring about the man. Why? Religion. You see, when you live life like that, constantly doing things out of obligation because you should do them, because it's what's expected of you, because it's the right thing to do, you soon find that the same thing happens to your own heart as it did to the Pharisees. It grows hard, it grows resentful, you find yourself feeling angry and irritated with other people. You want to do and give the absolute bare minimum to people rather than be generous, and you begin to lose your ability to respond to human need with compassion. Now, I totally know that's true for me when I do things out of obligation. But just look then back at the text, at what Jesus does in contrast. What does he do when he is faced with obligation? Well, at the end of the chapter, if you look at verses 31 to 34, he's teaching the crowds and his mum and his brothers are getting impatient, basically, waiting for him outside, thinking Jesus has been going on and on for hours. So they send a messenger in to do their dirty work to fetch him so they can go home. And Jesus responds by saying this, "Who are my mother and brothers? Here are my mother and brothers." Which we read and we think, ouch, how rude is that? If I said to my mum, "Mum, who are you?" She would be pretty livid with me. Now, we all know I've said worse to my mother, as thankfully that appears to have gone down in KXC history. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I once called her a disgusting woman and felt it was appropriate to share that, although apparently not so much. But anyway, if I said to my mum, "Mum, who are you?" which is probably something similar I've said to her in the past, I think she'd be pretty hurt. But the point is, Jesus wasn't willing to bend in to even his mum's demands on him. He didn't bend in, even though his mum was nagging at him, even if that meant actually hurting his own mother. Now, early in Mark chapter 1, Jesus is having some downtime, and Simon, one of the disciples, comes to find him and says, "What are you doing out here? Everybody is waiting for you. Everyone's waiting to hear what you want to do." But instead of feeling obliged and going, "Oh, all right then, Simon, I'll come back inside and share some thoughts with people," he says, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so that I can preach there also. That is why I have come." Well, you might remember these famous words from Jesus, which are recorded in John chapter 5, where he says, "I only do what I see the Father doing." Now, how was Jesus able to be free from obligation, free to disappoint people, free to let people down sometimes, free to say no to people? Rob Bell put it like this: Jesus knew how to say no because he'd already said yes. He knew how to say no because he'd already said yes. Here is a very basic illustration of the point. When somebody invites me to go for a drink with them on a Friday night, it's very easy for me to say no to them if I already said yes to someone else, if I've already made plans. If someone invites me to go for a drink on a Friday night and I haven't even thought about what I want to do on a Friday night and I haven't made any other plans, it's much more difficult for me to say no to them because I haven't said yes to anybody else yet. It's a basic illustration, but Jesus could say no to obligation because he'd already said yes. But what had he said yes to? I only do what I see the Father doing. He'd said yes to the purposes of the Father, and if the Father's purposes were for him to move on, and that meant him leaving some people behind, and they were upset about it, then that was okay. So I want you to think about your life now. What is it that you've said yes to? What are the things in your life that you have said yes to? Or to put it another way, where do you see the Father at work in your life? And what or who do you think he's calling you to give your time to right now? Maybe your money to right now, your energies to right now. You know, until you work that out, you will find it incredibly hard to say no to things or to say no to people. And I hold my hands up and say that this is a massive battleground for me. I am a huge and notorious people pleaser. I absolutely hate letting people down. I mean, I have a huge fear of upsetting people. And sometimes for me, the way that that manifests itself is that I'll constantly double book myself. Because I can't bear to say to somebody, oh, actually, no, I'm really sorry, I can't come to that. So I try and cram in more and more and more so that I never have to say to anyone, actually, no. Sometimes it kind of means that I don't get a night in because I just think I'm constantly saying yes, I don't want to say no to people. Now, I'm really working on that and try not to have that sense of overcrowding in my life. It's still something I have to watch. I'm still learning to say no. But how about you? How good are you at saying no? And are you tired at the moment? Are you tired at the moment? Could it be that part of the reason for your tiredness is that you really find it hard to say no to people? And are there things that you're doing in your life at the moment out of obligation that you maybe need to reassess whether you should be doing them or not? Finally then, just the last kind of bit of the passage that I want to talk about. But when I was preparing for this talk, I just had this sense that some of you here today are really tired. You've come in with this real sense of exhaustion. And it's not just because you've not had any of your own sort of boat time. It's not because you constantly do things out of obligation and you're kind of cramming your diary too full, but it's because you're experiencing opposition in your life. And for some of you, maybe that's in your workplace or maybe it's in a certain relationship you're in, but you feel as though you're in a fight. And maybe for some of you, it's not even like a physical situation, but just in your own sort of inner world, you feel like you're in a fight and you're tired of the fight. Well, Jesus was no stranger to opposition. If you look through Mark chapter 3 again, you'll see it. Look at verse 6. Just after Jesus has healed the man with the shriveled hand, the text says this. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Or verse 22. The teachers of the law who came down from Jerusalem said, he's possessed by Beelzebub, by the prince of demons, he's driving out demons. And again, as you go through Mark's gospel, you begin to see that emerge as a pattern. People opposing Jesus time and time again. But it's amazing to look at how Jesus responds. So take the incident on the Sabbath that we've just looked at as an example. Firstly, he stays true to what he knows the Father would have him do, and he heals the man anyway. Secondly, he confronts the Pharisees and their legalism and challenges them where he knows them to be wrong. But then look at what else he does. The following verse says, Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake. And I think that this is just, I'm going to whiz through this quickly, but I think this is an amazing model of how to deal with opposition, kind of human opposition, and when someone's opposing you, that means you don't burn out. Firstly, you do what Jesus did. You don't bend into it, and you stay true to what you know God has asked you to do, even if that's really costly. You stay true to what he's asked you to do. Secondly, there's a time when, with very carefully chosen words, you confront what you know to be wrong or evil. But thirdly, and I think this is so important, you withdraw with friends who are loyal to you, who will stand by you and who will fight with you and for you. But what I really wanted to talk about, what do you do when it's not just a sense of human opposition that you're coming up against, but there's something more to it than that? And this is where we get to the really interesting bit of the text that I was desperately trying to avoid about tying up the strong man. But we're going to read it anyway. It's from verse 23 onwards, and it says this. So Jesus called them and spoke to them in parables. How can Satan drive out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And if Satan opposes himself and is divided, he cannot stand. His end has come. In fact, no one can enter a strong man's house and carry off his possessions until he first ties up the strong man. Then he can rob his house. What the heck is going on in that little nugget of gold? Well, I think there's a couple of things happening here. Firstly, Jesus is just showing how ridiculously flawed their argument is. They were accusing him of being demon-possessed, and they themselves had seen him in action casting out demons. There's absolutely no logic in their argument. His point's essentially, how on earth can a demon cast out another demon? If that was the case, then Satan's kingdom would have come to an end. But then secondly, he goes into all this kind of cryptic stuff about the strong man. And Pete gave an absolutely brilliant explanation of this at Bible and Breakfast the other day, so I'm just going to unashamedly crib it and pass it on to you, as no doubt he has from somebody else, so I don't feel too terrible about it. But to understand what Jesus is saying here, you have to go back to Eden again. And I know what you're all thinking, oh, not again. We spend every week going back to Eden. But it is really important, I promise you, to understanding this part of the text, so stick with me. So this is how I'm going to explain it as best as I can. In the beginning, you have the Garden of Eden. Imagine the Garden of Eden, a little bit like a circle like that. It would be much better if I had a PowerPoint, but I'm not that way inclined. And then outside the garden, you have the wilderness. And in the wilderness, there were certain uncreatures that belonged to the wilderness. They were known to live in the wilderness. I don't know what they kind of all would have been, maybe a woolly mammoth or something of that sort of ilk. But there were these creatures that belonged to the wilderness, and they weren't allowed in the garden. And in the garden, God was king, and he put Adam and Eve in charge, kind of as that prince and princess figure. And their job was to keep those unclean creatures out of the garden, and to tend the garden, and to grow it so that it extended and eventually filled the wilderness into the rest of the world. So their job was to keep the creatures out. Now, one of the creatures that belonged to the wilderness was the serpent. He was known as belonging to the wilderness, and he wasn't allowed in the garden. So when Adam and Eve first have that encounter with the serpent in the garden, their first mistake isn't in having a chat with the serpent. Their first mistake is allowing the serpent in the garden in the first place. He never, ever should have been there. Their job, when if they saw the serpent lurking around, was to throw him out of the garden. But we know how the story goes. They did allow the serpent in there, and more than that, they had a conversation with him. And as a result, they lose their royal identity and they're banished from the garden. And when we reach the bit of a story that we're in the New Testament, the serpent or the enemy has himself begun to be known as the prince of this world. Just think about that. When Adam and Eve in the beginning, God was king. Adam and Eve, the prince and princess of this world. They've lost their identity. And by the time Jesus arrives on the scene, the enemy has come to be known as the prince of this world. In other words, he has robbed humanity of the role and authority that was always supposed to be theirs. But then when Jesus arrives on the scene, you can read about this in Matthew's gospel, you see him enter back into the wilderness. It's known as the temptation narratives, when Jesus enters back into the wilderness, the place where it all kind of evil came from in the first place, and where the enemy again tries to undermine Jesus in his royal identity. Where Adam and Eve bent, Jesus doesn't. Jesus remains true and he wins back humanity's royal identity, and then he goes about giving back that royal identity to his disciples, and with it the authority that was always rightfully theirs. So, when Jesus talks about tying up the strong man, he's essentially saying that for far too long the enemy has been ruling in this world, but not anymore. God is king, he's returned, and the enemy is no longer the prince of this world. That role was always the role of humanity, and it's been restored to them again. And with that role, the authority again to drive out the enemy wherever they see him at work. And when he's been driven out, Jesus will restore creation once more. Now, I appreciate that's a big mouthful and that's a lot to take in, but it's really important practically speaking, because the point is this. Jesus is essentially saying that he has given us authority wherever we see the enemy at work to say to him, you don't belong in here, get out. You don't belong in here, get out. Just as Adam and Eve were meant to do with the serpent in the beginning. You know, many of us are probably from church traditions or maybe not from church background at all, and we shy away from talking about the enemy or the demonic because we've probably all met people who are absolutely obsessed with it and find demons in their cereal and things like that. And we think we definitely don't want to be that sort of person, so we don't talk about it. We feel a bit embarrassed talking about experiencing any sense of opposition that isn't just human. And whilst I'm not suggesting for one moment that we all leave here and start labelling everything that we see in our lives as opposition, as demonic, as somehow from the enemy, I think we do ourselves and we do the scriptures a great disservice when we just dismiss it entirely. C.S. Lewis said this: "There are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight." I wanted to end by just reading you a quick story. And this comes from Richard Foster's book, Money, Sex and Power, which is an absolute classic, even though it's got a horrible front cover. But he basically tells the story about how when he came to write the section on power, he was writing this bit about destructive power and talking about the different destructive powers that are kind of at work in our age. But as he came to write it, this really weird thing started happening to him, and he just felt really depressed and really oppressed, and he just couldn't seem to sit down to write it. And he's kind of experienced that opposition, and this is how he explains what happens. Stick with it. It's like reading a granddad speaking. It's lovely. This is what he says. "By Wednesday of the first week of rewriting, I began to sense a heaviness and darkness come over me. I'm sure it was partly due to emotional and physical weariness with the task, for I'd been writing for 9 months with hardly a break and had done considerable research before that. By Friday, the darkness was nearly overwhelming. I felt as though I never wanted to write again, speak again, or teach again. I'd look over a chapter and want to just throw it away. I tried to think of some way to cancel the entire project. Even now, I cannot fully explain what I was feeling. To use the words of George Fox, I was nearly overcome by an ocean of darkness. Anyone who studied psychology will know that what I'm describing shows telltale signs of the beginning stages of exhaustion. That was certainly a factor in my experience, but it didn't seem to account for everything I felt. There seemed to be more to it, some deeper, greater foreboding. On Saturday, I went to my office to write, but with no hope of producing anything worth reading. During a period of meditation and prayer, I thought of the time Martin Luther threw his ink bottle at the devil. Instinctively, I grabbed my pen and threw it against the wall, breaking it. I said to myself, well, if the devil is here, I probably missed him. I tried to arm myself with the weapons of Ephesians 6, but it seemed to do little good. In the late morning, a group of 5 friends came to pray for me. We talked only briefly, and then they prayed quietly. Though I cooperated with their efforts, I had absolutely no expectation that it would do any good. I felt nothing at all. After they left, however, the heaviness began to lift just a bit. As the day went on, things got brighter and brighter, until by evening the darkness was completely gone. I was able then to finish my task without further oppression. A few days later, one member of the group that had come Saturday morning told me that during the prayer, she had seen the entire room being filled with the light of Christ and the evil powers being thrust outside. I didn't see anything, but I don't doubt her word, for she's a spiritually alert person and not in the least given to mystic fantasy. I believe it also because the ocean of darkness was indeed overcome by the ocean of light and life. All of this may sound strange to you, but it did happen, and perhaps it can stand as a witness that the principalities and powers are real and do indeed wage war against us. It can also witness to the importance of having others who can help us as we do battle against the powers in this dark, evil age. The powers are strong, but Christ is stronger still. The defeat of the powers is sure. We live in the life that overcomes the world, and we should expect to see the overthrow of the kingdom of darkness and the inauguration of Christ's rule of righteousness wherever we go." Now, some of you listening to that story might have thought, that's a pretty average story. I wonder why she hasn't chosen one that's much better and more exciting about spiritual opposition and demons flying all over the room. But I tell that story for 2 reasons. Firstly, precisely because it's not a spectacular one. And actually, I think it's probably far more true to a lot of our own experience of what spiritual opposition can be like in our lives. And secondly, because it illustrates the point of the importance of having friends around you that will stand with you and fight for you in those moments when you're experiencing opposition. So I do just want to ask you the question, are you experiencing opposition in your life right now? You know, maybe there's something that you know God's called you to do, but it's just like you keep hitting up against a brick wall every time you try and do it. Maybe there's a pattern of behaviour or an addiction that you just cannot break out of, and you've tried everything, but you just cannot break out of it. You know, maybe there's just a certain lie for you that plays over and over and over in your head. Maybe you feel overcome, like Richard Foster talked about, by an ocean of darkness. You know, whatever it is, the task for us, together with our friends around us, is to recognise that voice, that nagging fear, the sense of heaviness as opposition from the enemy, and to look it straight in the face and say, you do not belong in here. Get out. So I don't know where you're at today. How would you answer that question we started with at the beginning? How are you doing? Are you tired? And if so, could it partly be that you simply just need to find your boat? You need to take time out and be refreshed. Could it be that you need to let go of some of the things that you're doing out of a sense of duty or obligation and focus instead on the things you know God's called you to do? Or could it be that you're actually facing some sort of opposition right now? And with the support of friends who love you, you need to face the enemy head on and say, with your authority restored to you in Christ Jesus, you do not belong in here. Let's stand.